welcome once again to EW10's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our guest author is Dr. Jason M. Baxter. His book, Why Literature Still Matters, Cassiodorus Press, all available, of course, through the EW10 religious catalog, EW10RC.com for all things Catholic. Great to see you again, Doctor.
Good to see you.
You were back on the show about 8 years or so ago, I think.
That's
it,
right.
Was.
Yeah. We talked some Dante.
Book. Yeah, Dante. Well, Dante is very interesting. He kind of shows up in this book, too, doesn't he?
It's impossible for him not to show up in this book. Yeah.
So you say why literature still matters. Is there a question about that?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think, you look at, say, the Common Core, you look at sort of, you know, literacy rates, mm-hmm.
What was wrong with Common Core in your mind?
I spend a lot of time in the book of Why Literature Still Matters talking about the mechanization of our minds, mm-hmm. right? The mechanization of our souls, in which we've sort of absorbed all these thoughts about that the chief good, maybe almost the exclusive good of our lives is being productive and consuming and producing. And you even have words like consuming and producing that kind of sneak into our vocabulary mm-hmm. and affect our emotions about ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, Bill Gates himself said that the goal of Common Core was to standardize education like the electrical socket had been standardized. Mm-hmm. When you start to think about what the sort of deep psychology, the deep metaphysics of mm-hmm. what he thinks a human soul is, a human soul just, you know, has an outlet that needs to be plugged in, drawn some juice and some resources mm-hmm. so that then it can work. Obviously, that's
so
one
just of, making widgets basically is what
exactly,
we're doing.
Exactly, right, exactly. That's one of the things
and
that we get
to do. And then who decides what it is to be educated?
Exactly.
Which is always the big problem.
Right, it's the people paying, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, in light of that, what I like to tell my students is don't think of yourself as sort of as a computer or plugging yourself into an electrical outlet, but what if we thought of ourselves like a piano, right? Like the soul is like a piano. It has 88 keys. It can go deep. It can go high. It has sort of varied sounds that it can make, right? But the thing is, as we think as, you know, with Catholics, that some of those strings are out of tune. And so an education is kind of going with, you know, individual tuning forks like a, you know, like a piano tuner will mm-hmm. do, listening and retuning each one of those strings. And so I say, in contrast to the Common Core, a literary inspired education, but also history, theology, philosophy, would think about those individual strings and retune them, right, so that we can cooperate in, you know, kind of fixing the soul in a way or getting it back to what it was meant to be.
Now, you say that this book is Why Literature Matters, and you talk about what does literature feel like? That's your first question.
Yeah.
Your second question is, why has it become so difficult for us to read? Well, the second one we can go over, and maybe most of us would have a kind of a sense of why that might be the truth. But right. The idea that literature feels, what do you mean? Tactile.
Yeah, I mean that I say in the book that literature is the way that we close the gap between what we see and what we admire and who we are. Mm-hmm. And that I kind of, you know, halfway borrow it from C.S. Lewis, who said that every time we have an experience of beauty, whether it's with our own families, right, with the kids, right, or some sort of natural landscape or a painting mm-hmm. or a poem or a song, we have this little bit of sorrow that it's out there and I'm over here, mm-hmm. right? There's a little bit of sorrow that it's that we can't sort of complete that union. So I say that arts and painting and literature is that vehicle by which we get some of that into here, or borrowing right. the very Catholic metaphor of one of my beloved teachers, we don't just want to see beauty, we want to eat it.
Okay. Throughout this book, I will frequently compare literature to painting and architecture and music. I want to know what literature would sound like if it would melted down and turned into music, or what literature would look like if it crystallized and became the visual arts. And you really talk about being immersed in a landscape.
Yes.
Why a landscape?
I think because, you know, say if you're reading off the box of Cheerios, the ingredients that, or the, you know, the vitamins or the minerals that you're going to mm-hmm. get from it, right? There's a mode of reading which is kind of, you know, all cerebral. It's all in the brain, right? There's a way that we read, and we need to read it because mm-hmm. we're overstimulated, right? We have to sift through all kinds of information and mm-hmm. data to find the right stuff. But then there's a way of reading which is not just to get information or data, but it's to try to absorb, it's to try to become, right? It's when we, say, read a sentiment in a good religious book and think, wow, that's true. but it's not true about me. And I go back and reread it and think, oh, I wish it were true about me. And I reread it, and I reread it, and I reread it. I like to tell my students that if you, again, we've already compared the soul to a piano, right? But we could also compare the soul to a camera, right? Mm-hmm. Like an old-fashioned camera, that when the aperture opens, there's that photosensitive film which captures the light, right? In moments of wonder, we sort of open up and go, oh, without being blasphemous, oh Lord, right? Oh God, is that true? Mm-hmm. And when we sort of expose our souls to the process of wonder, some of what we admire out there becomes just a little bit part of ourselves.
When did you experience that the last time? Give me an example of that in your own personal life.
I've been blessed. I've experienced it so many times. Sometimes it's simple, sometimes it's domestic. Mm-hmm. Like going to a fireworks show with the kids at night and carrying, you know, a toddler on my shoulders at, you know, at midnight while the firecrackers are still going, mm-hmm. and then being hugged by your little girl, mm-hmm. because she's so pleased, and you think, this is so beautiful, I wish it could last forever. Mm-hmm. And if you were an artist, you could kind of reach into that experience, freeze it, hold it, sort of capture the light in a crystal, mm-hmm. like Sam's file in Lord of the Rings, okay. right? And I think that's, you know, I think that's art. But I've experienced a lot with music, mm-hmm. right? With the classical music of Bach, with the romantic music of Mendelssohn. I talk about Mendelssohn's Overture to the Hebrides here, and I still experience it with Dante. I'm a translator of Dante now, mm-hmm. so I've been professionally made to read each one of these three books, mm-hmm. 20, 30, maybe even 40 times. Mm-hmm. But I still come across certain passages where I go, how did you do that, man? Mm-hmm. So I think I'm a lucky one, mm-hmm. getting to be a professor of literature. Yeah. I frequently bump into these things, right. but I write about a couple of moments, my Sardinia experience.
Right, you have two great experiences. You kind of bookend the thing with Sardinia and Iceland. One you view as a much more upbeat one, though it seems like you almost died. And then the Iceland one, which I guess one from a natural experience would think, that tends to be a little more depressive as far as a place you'd want to spend time in.
Yeah.
How did you end up in both of those places?
Yeah, so I just we went to Sardinia in the middle of the COVID pandemics, and it was when things sort of calmed down a little bit.
Did you do that on purpose?
We were excited about going, and we deferred it in 2020 and had a chance to go in 2021.
Okay, wasn't it you went there to avoid like COVID restrictions or something like that?
Well, we thought that's what we were doing, and, mm-hmm. and it was pretty relaxed, and so we sort of avoided waves, but then everyone kind of got all serious again. So we kind of snuck in and mm-hmm. snuck out right mm-hmm. when that international travel was possible, right?
Okay.
So we went through a lot to get there and sacrificed a lot. But on one particular day, you know, I'm a father of six, so you have to ask your wife's permission to take some time off. She said, you know what? This day is yours. Go do mm-hmm. what you want.
Right.
So I went out to do a hike, and I was going to climb up to this cliff so I could see the Bay of Hell. The Cala d'Inferno, right? Being a Dante guy, I wanted mm-hmm. to see what hell looked like, or the entrance into hell. But while I was going up there, I got lost, and the sun got hot, it's the Mediterranean, I ran out of water, and my brain started roasting. And so I was sort of, you know, scurrying from patch of shade to patch of
shade.
You
said my brain had gone Hemingway.
That's right, yeah. It stopped speaking in complete sentences. It was just like water, scuttle, scuttle, shade, trees, hurry, hurry, you know. And so, yeah, my literary brain went full on Hemingway. And then I found this little 15th century cave.
Yeah, a hut or something,
yeah,
right?
I crawled into it.
Right.
Wasn't exactly sure what it was. And I sat there in the cool mud, and I smiled. And then, as I say in the book, I smiled at my smiling because I thought, this is ridiculous. Who spends $3,000 and, you know, has Q-tips stuck up his nose for COVID test mm-hmm. and avoid, you know, does all this, everything that I went through to mm-hmm. sit in the mud and smile at himself, right? Like, what's wrong with me? And that's when it struck me, this particular beautiful passage from C.S. Lewis, mm-hmm. in which he talks about how our ancient writers, you know, the tellers of myth, were not trying to do science, right? But they were trying to close the gap between what they saw and who they were. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, despite the fact that this is a near-death experience, right?
Right.
And I'm sitting in the mud, that's why I love this, because all of a sudden I've become close to this place. I'm not just a tourist, mm-hmm. right? But now I'm part of the ecosystem. And that, in my mind, I think, well, that was really the beginning of this mm-hmm. book, because I thought, that's exactly what literature does. Mm-hmm. Literature is like a landscape.
Yeah, in the Lewis, you talk about the fundamental characteristic of beauty, that is, when we encounter beauty, is almost always accompanied by a strange note of sorrow, a sorrow that arises because beauty feels like something over there, something external to me, which is what you're talking about. So when you were there, I mean, did you come to some level of acceptance? I guess I'm just going to die?
Yeah, I still was too stubborn to call the Italian police. I thought that'd be embarrassing to be airlifted out of this thing, right? So I think I'm just going to have to...
Did you have cell? did you have a cell phone? Did you have any bars, as they say?
Yeah, like barely. Yeah, I had one. I had, you know, like 10% left, you know. So I was just telling my wife, you know, it's like, hey, pray for me.
Right. Because you did get in touch with her.
I did.
And she did pray for you. And she
did. I mean, right? I guess that all the young men out there should be advised. You need to have a saintly wife, right? Not just a pretty one. So anyway, so she was praying for me there, and then as I was, you know, stumbling down this hill, this wonderful French couple, Cedric and Marisa, whose names will never leave my memory, came up. I hadn't seen or heard of anyone for 5 or 6 hours. Mm-hmm. They came up and said, "Do you need any water?" Mm-hmm. I said, "Yes, I do." Mm-hmm. And they gave me a liter, and then that gave me just enough to get back down to town. Yeah.
Yeah. To follow up on what you said, if we keep in mind that literature is driven by the desire to close the gap between what I see and what I am, then will we be more patient with the old authors, like you were saying?
That's right.
Especially in those passages, as you were just discussing. Now, going back before the Sardinia experience, you also talked about the apocalypse of the imagination earlier in the book, right. And you were talking about Zuckerberg and his wife giving away 99% of their wealth.
Promising to do that.
And you had a problem with that. What was your problem with it?
Yeah, no, it seems kind of perverse, doesn't it? Like, I mean, who could disagree with this? But the origin of that for me is that I would read this letter to my students. And, you know, they're making these extraordinary claims. But my students would sort of, you know, nod suspiciously, like, okay. Mm-hmm. And I just ask the simple question, why are you not more excited about this, right? Doesn't it seem everything which is good? And there was something off, which I, at that point, I couldn't even explain to myself, right?
It was just a sense that...
Yeah, why are we not more excited about this? Uh-huh. Doesn't this seem like the perfect press release? And so in the book...
Because it was geared towards their son, wasn't it? In the sense of, like,
yeah, for
child,
the daughter, Max, yeah.
Rather, their daughter, Max.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's this open letter that they wrote on the occasion of the birth of their daughter about how they intend to assemble all these resources so that her productivity and experiences will be greater than theirs, and it feels like all the right things. Mm-hmm. So what I did was conduct a proper literary analysis of it, which, you know, seems like, you know, kind of overkill, but I compared it with an older poet of W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet, who also wrote a poem upon the occasion of the birth of his daughter.
A Prayer for My Daughter, right?
That's right. And when you compare those things, all kinds of interesting things come out. But one of the things that comes out is how many different things Yeats felt that he needed to draw upon in the world, or to go back to our piano. Yeats felt that he needed all the keys on the piano board to sound the depth of the soul, or I like to put it, the soul is as deep as the world is wide. Whereas Zuckerberg was content with these kind of applications from mathematical functions to describe what he intended for the life of his daughter. Mm-hmm. And that's when all of a sudden I went, oh, that's what it is. It's suffocating. Mm-hmm. I mean, is productivity good? Is efficiency good? Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. It's one of the, you know, the great skills and powers of our age. The problem is, it's maybe one of, to cast out a random important sounding number, maybe one of 33 different virtues and skills and values that we need to have a full human life. Mm-hmm. And if you just sort of extract it and pretend that these other things don't sort of play into our depth, into our wholeness, into our relationships, into our happiness, you have a very suffocating vision of life. Mm-hmm. And what I think, what worried me the most in sort of reading this to my students and to myself is that it wasn't immediately obvious why this letter felt so suffocating, indicating to me that we've already forgotten a lot, and thus thus literature is not cute or sweet or entertaining, but actually to read it, it has a sense of urgency right now.
You say clearly the way that Yeats is not scientific, but neither is he naive or primitive, which is what we living in this technological age often reflexively think of when we hear things that we believe are quote-unquote unscientific, and you talk about the idea of being in communion with nature and being at peace with himself for Yeats.
Yes.
How can you sense that?
I mean, the reality is being good and being deep, being holy, being the best version of myself, it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It takes a lifetime, and it takes discipline, it takes effort, and it takes tools, right? Just as it takes, you know, tools of technology for us to send, you know, we have to have servers and data farms and all the stuff to engage in the power of our communication, good things, right? Similarly, we need to have tools and power to excavate our own depth and to become the types of people that we really want to become, right? And so I think that's really what I've been, you know, thinking about in terms of, in light of contemporary culture, right? It's not necessarily that our technological tools are bad, but if we only value them and if we only have them, then we're going to be evacuating our own inwardness, our own interiority, as we sort of push it to the periphery of our being.
Well, you say the Irish poet with one foot in antiquity and one foot on the great pavement of modernity knows that the soul is as deep as the world is wide, and then you bring in Franz Liszt.
That's right. Yeah, the composer, pianist, who is famous for his chromaticism, right? Mm-hmm. Playing all those little notes in between the other notes, the black notes, right? Mm-hmm. But also famous for his sort of big booming chords, which go all the way up to the treble clef and go all the way down to the bass clef. So what I'm asking for is, and in the book I have some fun analyzing a couple of pop songs, right? Mm-hmm. Again, catchy, fun, enjoyable, but they're not going down to the bass clefs, right? They're not going down to those lowest possible notes, and I'm using this as a metaphor, of course, right? Those lowest possible notes of the soul. They're not dealing with the brokenness and the fragmented nature of being a human. They're not dealing with my envy. They're not dealing with what the church fathers called our septic wounds of the soul. But they're also not talking about the sort of highest longings, right? Which are beyond comfort is good. Mm-hmm. Happiness and sort of having a great family is good, right? But we have even higher longings, even for a soaring which exceeds even those things. Literature, you know, at least in the sort of the great books, the great poets, right, as well as the great musicians, the great painters, deals with a full range of the human soul.
Right. I have to admit, I didn't recognize the songs that you were referencing anyway. Orphic tradition. What is the Orphic tradition?
Right. Yeah. It refers to the ancient mythological poet of Orpheus, who, according to the wonderful ancient mythology, was so good at playing the lyre and singing that he could make trees sway. Mm-hmm. Right. And he could calm wild animals. And he could even go down to hell in one of these sort of great myths and play and calm hell down for a while, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is that the human soul and the world were made for each other. Mm-hmm. And that the world is not merely a set of resources waiting for us to excavate, you know, mine and then turn it into products to enhance our comfort and power. Mm-hmm. Those things are okay. Those are legitimate human pursuits and crafts, right? But there's also this other aspect that the world is meant to be reflected upon, to be internalized, to be admired. And then the artist tries to describe it with his words, with his film, you being a great film lover, right?
Right.
With his painting,
well,
with his music.
Well, you do have Modern Times. I was going to get to that. That one I know. So you use Modern Times as an example in here. The other thing that struck me was to use the term datification, a lifestyle of datification. What is that?
Yeah, that is... We sort of, one of my beloved philosophers says, think about how we present ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. We update a post and say, hey, I'm, you know, drinking this latte right now at this cool little shop, right? Or I just bought these shoes, or I'm just about to go to, we sort of break our lives down into little kilobytes of units in which we share, right? But there are all these-
Is that why we can turn ourselves into human emojis?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly, that's the sort of amplification effect, right? But we've sort of fragmented our lives into, you know, itty-bitty little bits, and thus thus our lives become a kind of data cloud of experiences, of consumption or emotions. But just because these experiences are sort of hovering around doesn't mean we yet have a narrative, a mission, a story, right? And that's... I think that's part of the datification of our world. Right.
You say perhaps it's not surprising that some researchers estimate that the daily active vocabulary of teenagers is down to 800 words a day.
That's right.
What did it used to be?
That's a great question. I suppose we'd have to give Shakespeare a phone and see how he
texted his
friends, right? But I think, you know, a professional has a vocabulary of somewhere between, you know, 40 to 50,000 words, right? Thomas Hardy allegedly has a vocabulary of somewhere around 85,000 words, right? But the sort of expectation would be that you would aspire to those higher and higher levels.
Right.
Whereas for us, the sort of expectation is that we sort of aspire to the faster, the quicker, and even sort of avoid
bottom
words.
Bottom line it.
Yeah, avoid words entirely by replacing them with emojis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and you say the rich language we've inherited made up of metaphors, adjectives, and adverbs, you know, we're losing those things. Do you like Scooby-Doo characters, or were you a fan of Scooby-Doo, or?
I mean, I think it's probably hard not to be a fan of Scooby-Doo when you're a kid.
How did he get in this book?
I analyzed this this music video of a song by a group called One Republic. Mm-hmm. And what interests me so much is that when they represent themselves as animated characters, like Scooby-Doo characters. Mm-hmm. And it feels to me like this sort of, they're infantilizing themselves, right? They're sort of presenting themselves as you know, these simpler colors and these simple figures. But again, my argument is that they have sort of voluntarily reduced themselves to mere figures of consumption, racing around like little Pac-Man in the old video game, trying to eat as many of those dots as they can get.
Right. You talk about the fact that Zuckerberg's vision of the world is anesthetizing and sedative, sedative, I should say, because it has eliminated all complexity and all resistance. It's interesting because that ties right into Brave New World.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
With Soma and, you know, that whole idea of...
That's right.
You know.
And then, one of the great moments in Brave New World is discovering a book of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard for John to read it at first.
Right.
But as he begins to accustom himself to the variety of words, Huxley says that he begins to actually discover, wait a minute, depth of feelings. In some sense, emotions that kind of had sort of been dormant in his own heart.
Mm-hmm.
Until he had the linguistic capacity to touch them, and then they began to open up.
You talk about the poetic stickiness. What is that?
I mean the way that a poet works, and that he's not chiefly interested in communicating as many kilobytes of information to you as possible. He's not trying to give you like a stream of facts. It's not datification. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. But rather, what he's trying to do is use interesting metaphors, interesting words. He's trying to connect things through patterns and rhythm. He's doing everything he can to sort of slow down the experience, which sort of, as I've said, opens up the shutters of wonder so that you can receive what he's discussing. You could say poetic stickiness is the creation of literary slow time, so that I'll slow down, pay attention, open my eyes, open my soul.
Experience.
Experience, and then I can hope, to use a fun metaphor, to download and not just to stream.
You quote Spencer here, and you talk about the, interesting, I thought, would have used the word amplification, a word we also use to describe art of modernity. But for our pre-modern ancestors, amplification was different. And you say amplification wasn't connected to amps and amperes and getting amped up, but to ampleness.
That's right. Yeah, that, I mean, if you've ever picked up an old book, you know, a Shakespeare sonnet, a Shakespeare play, right? If you've ever read, you know, an old book, say before, we'll say 1700, Homer, Dante, there are all these moments, and I've experienced this a lot with my, you know, with my students over my teaching career, in which the students go in with a sense of goodwill, and they start reading, and they go, why does it feel like this? What's wrong with this book? And I think in a single word, you could say, well, our definition of ample or amplification has changed. For us, in our age of technology and physics and rapid communication, right, the great good is amplification. It's as much as possible in the same amount of time.
Right.
Whereas for our ancestors, they also wanted amplification. But what they meant was something more generous, more spacious, something which was ample, right? Something which you could say in which they made our world of time and history act more like eternity by means of us slowing it down. So for us, everything is temporal.
Mm-hmm.
For them, it was spatial.
Right. Now, is Phineas Fogg really Mark Zuckerberg's grandfather?
Absolutely.
In what way?
The genetic tests have been performed.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, no, there's a fun moment in which I've mortally offended some of my friends and students by trotting out poor old Phileas Fogg, right? Jules mm-hmm. Verne's character from Around the World in 80 Days. And by sort of, putting poor old Phileas Fogg on the couch and, you know, analyzing him like a psychologist, I've identified him as the grandfather of modernity, right? Mm-hmm. And then jokingly compare him to Steve Jobs and to Mark Zuckerberg as well. But basically that new mentality, right, of the amplification to turn myself into a superpower of efficiency and productivity, I sort of date in the literary imagination to Phileas Fogg. So poor old Phileas Fogg gets it bad in the book.
Right. I don't think a lot of people remember that movie anymore.
So Jules Verne readers should probably just, not even bother with purchasing.
So let me ask you, in just the closing seconds we have here, how did you end up in Iceland and how did that impact this book?
I had just come from a trip in Oxford in which I was doing an event on C.S. Lewis and stopped on Iceland on the way and had a remarkable experience with a waterfall. Mm-hmm. Almost spiritual. I don't want to get weird and new agey, right? Mm-hmm. But I was left there in silence and wonder. And then people kept coming in front of me to take pictures of themselves in front of it. And I thought, I don't know if that's a sufficient response to the majesty of this. Mm-hmm. I need to write a book about what would be.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yes. It's amazing how center focused we've put ourselves in the universe. And what do we think? We're the center of the universe. Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Dr. Jason M. Baxter, author of Why Literature Still Matters, Cassiodorus Press, and of course available through our EWTN religious catalog. You'll see them also, or would have seen them, on with Father Mitch on EWTN Live. I'm Doug Keck. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time right here on Bookmark.